Well, it's very nice to be here today. So what is Peter Pan all about? What I'm going to try and talk to you about today is what Peter Pan was originally all about, because it has changed over the years. And what I'm interested in is the original texts as written by J.M. Barrie and what can be found in there. And my argument is that they're actually all about child development, which is why I'm talking here now. Now, J.M. Barrie was born in 1860, just after the publication of the Darwin's Origin of Species, and that is important because there's a lot of post-Darwinian anxiety, if you like, appearing in the books as that he wrote later. Peter Pan, obviously Pan is the god Pan, the god of nature, wildness, non-civilised way of life, and on one of the very early editions of Peter Pan, you can see little Pan is playing the pipes, the Pan pipes, which gives you the clue that the Pan is an allusion to the original Greek god of nature. So nature's going to come into it somewhere. There are two important books, Peter Pan in Kensington Gardens, where Peter is only a week old. And then there's the more familiar Pan when he's older. Peter Pan, the Peter in Kensington Gardens, first appeared as a few chapters in another serious and sinister book for adults called The Little White Bird. And that was published in 1902. And then the Peter Pan part was extracted and republished in 1904 as a more accessible book, with illustrations by Arthur Rackham. The Peter Pan you're more familiar with, the pantomime, was written as a pantomime in 1904 and then published as a book in 1911. And in that one, Peter is 7 years old. That's the story you are more familiar with. Now, the orientation of my argument is that what J.M. Barrie is doing is he is exploring the contents of his own mind rather than looking at the outside world and writing a story about anything outside himself. He's introspecting. That the Neverland that he describes is a timeless daydream or night dream. That Peter is Barrie's memory of himself as a child, because Peter can be various ages, but doesn't age chronologically. And if you think back to when you were 5, you were 5. And if you think about when you were 10, you were 10. But your memories don't age chronologically, but they can be different ages. And Peter has different cognitive styles depending on how old he is. And the fairies, which appear from time to time, are actually part of Peter's imagination, so they share Peter's cognitive abilities. Now, I'm going to divide the story up into three sections: between sleep and wakefulness, between infant and adult, and between animal and human, because these all appear in the stories. Peter is described as a betwixt and between. And so we get the feeling that there are comparisons going on here. The examples of sleep come in many forms and remind us that Barrie is inside his own mind rather than talking about the world out there. Between infant and adult is obviously the child development work, and between animal and human is the post-Darwinian part. Before Darwin, people were made in God's image and animals were beasts. So why on earth would you want to compare the cognitive abilities of humans and animals? But having been persuaded, if you were, by Darwin that we all evolved from animals, then not only did our bodies evolve, but our minds must have evolved as well, and therefore comparisons become worthy and anxiety-provoking as well. So if we start with between sleep and wakefulness, there are many illustrations of peculiar alterations of consciousness appearing in the two books. First of all, there is a great deal of flying, where a lot of people fly in their dreams, but don't fly really. Then there are vivid or hypercoloured dreams and lucid dreams, which are somewhat interactive, where you can actually interfere with your own dreams. Oh, don't like the way this is going, and change it round a bit. Now, I see some nods and I see some raised eyebrows. If you experience vivid and lucid dreams, you will nod. If you don't, well, I'm sorry, but other people do. There's also hypnagogic hallucinations, which are dreamlike sequences that appear just as you're dropping off to sleep. And there's false awakening, where you wake up, roll over, get up, clean your teeth, put your coat on, set off for work, wake up, find you're still in bed, and you've got to do it all over again. I used to do this a lot as a student. I don't do it now. Intrusions into waking, where you start worrying at lunchtime that you haven't fed the cat, and you get really upset about how on earth you're going to cope with getting back home to feed the cat, and then eventually it dawns on you that you don't have a cat. That's why you haven't fed it. You don't have one. And these are kind of dreams that are kind of nagging at you. Sleepwalking. Normally when you're asleep, your muscles are relaxed to the point that you cannot use them, and so you don't act out your dreams. But if the mechanism between movement and consciousness goes wrong, then you can move, and you sometimes do, and act out things and sleepwalk. Cataplexy is a rare phenomenon where the opposite happens. You are awake, but your muscle tone goes to sleep, but not your consciousness, and so you lose muscle tone and fall down. But it's not a faint, it's a kind of trance, I suppose one might call it. And sleep paralysis is related to these two, where you wake up, but your muscle tone doesn't come back, so you are paralysed, and you experience some extremely unpleasant visitations, sometimes of a sexual nature, sometimes of an aggressive nature, and it leads to the ideas that other people will describe as being abducted by aliens. Most of those descriptions actually, they're not really being abducted by aliens, they're experiencing sleep paralysis. Now, Barry almost certainly experienced all of these things because he mentions them in his more autobiographical works. He includes them in his stories, often for no particular reason. He thinks, why is that there? Well, he's using his own material, but he's also saying, I am talking about consciousness, not about reality. Okay? Now, if we move on in sleep, why do we have to go to sleep? Or, to be more precise, why do we lose consciousness when we go to sleep? Why don't we just lie down and rest the muscles? After all, losing consciousness is dangerous. People can attack you, steal things from you, and so on. Clearly, we have to lose consciousness, because if we don't sleep, we become extremely ill over the course of 2 or 3 days. So we have to do, it's got something to do with consciousness. And the current theory now is that one of the things that happens while you're unconscious is that your memories get repacked and shuffled off from a shortish type of memory, a buffer memory, into a more long-term memory. Your episodic memories, that's memories of events, become reorganized and made into a story and then packed away as part of your autobiographical memory. That's the current theory. But I rather think that Barry got there first. I'm going to read you a little passage because it shows you this, but it also shows you the superb language in which he wrote, which of course is now sadly lost in all the adaptations. We're talking about when Peter steals the Darling children from Mr. and Mrs. Darling and takes them away by flying to Neverland, where they have all their adventures. So Mrs. Darling comes in to see what's going on. But this had been going on for some time. Something funny had been going on in the night. Mrs. Darling first heard of Peter when she was tidying up her children's minds. It is the nightly custom of every good mother, after her children are asleep, to rummage in their minds and put things straight for the next morning, repacking into their proper places the many articles that have wandered during the day. If you could keep awake, but of course you can't, you would see your own mother doing this. And you would find it very interesting to watch her. It is quite like tidying up drawers. You would see her on her knees, I expect, lingering humorously over some of your comments, what contents, wondering where on earth you would pick this thing up, making discoveries sweet and not so sweet, pressing this to her cheek as if it were as nice as a kitten, and hurriedly stowing that out of sight. When you wake in the morning, the naughtiness and evil passions with which you went to bed have been folded up small and placed at the bottom of the mind, and on the top, beautifully aired, are spread out your prettier thoughts ready for you to put on. This appears in the stage directions of the play. Right? But it is beautiful language, and it epitomises what a good night's sleep really does for you. So many of those sorts of things appear. I have to rattle on because I don't have a huge amount of time. Now, between infant and adult, this is the aspects of child development that he was talking about. Now, remember, he's writing in 1900. Pre-Piaget, before Freud became commonplace in the English language in England, before most psychology was, before behaviourism, before all those other sorts of psychology that came later. He is actually closest to cognitive psychology as is now, but he was writing it off his own bat. There were very few textbooks of psychology in those days. There were one or two which I'll come to. Now, so between infant and adult, now what you have to do as a tiny baby, you get all this sensory input comes in. The first thing you have to do is to divide the sensory input up into objects and not objects. So you have to develop what I've called a theory of things. Is this a thing? Is this a background, a foreground, and so on? It's learning to see. Now that's fine, but not everything is an object. So having learnt what object permanence is, when you play with your child and you play peekaboo and you cover something up and then it comes, you bring it back again and the child giggles, you are teaching them object permanence. Things can go away and they can come back. But some things go away and don't come back. Wind, smoke, shadows, these do not have object permanence. And he plays with this to amuse us because we're expecting the right boundaries and he plays with them. So in the house on the left, which is the house they built for Mamie, where Mamie is an early version of Wendy, so really it's a Wendy house, the fairies have all built this little house. And then right at the very end, they climb up and tie the smoke on with a piece of wire. And you think, whoops, boundaries, something's gone wrong here. So that's what he's up to. And as many children's authors will do, he has animate and inanimate objects that break the rules. The plants come alive at night and walk about and grumble about life. And unlike other children's authors where the animals are often speaking toys directed towards the child themselves. These plants and animals have a life of their own and think the children are a bit of a nuisance, really, which is a slightly different angle, but they're there. Now I want to move on to a much more complicated, sophisticated form of object, beloved of economists and the like. Now these are socially constructed objects, which is an object which only exists as it is because we all believe in it, and if we don't believe in it, it ceases to exist. The most important example is money. All right? Money can be pieces of paper, gold, cowrie shells, promissory notes, you name it, it doesn't really matter. If we all accept them as valid, that's fine. If a currency collapses, the paper that it's written on is it's just worthless. Right? It disappears like smoke. So these are socially constructed objects. And Barry seems to have picked up on this. He has a story which exemplifies this, which is quite complicated. He tells a story of a £5 note, which is used as a piece of paper and as a unit of currency. As a piece of paper, it's divisible geometrically, you can cut it up. And as a piece of currency, you can divide it up arithmetically into what in those days was pounds, shillings and pence. All right? So he does both, and I'll paraphrase the story just so that you get the feel of him twisting backwards and forwards. Peter has flown to Bird Island, which is an island in Kensington Gardens, but he cannot leave because he's forgotten how to fly. A poet, the sort of person who never exactly grows up and who despises money, makes a toy boat out of a £5 note and floats it across to Bird Island. But the birds do not know the value of money, so they give it to Peter to play with. Because Peter knows that money is valuable, but he doesn't know quite how. He knows it's something. So he cuts the banknote up into sixpenny-sized pieces and pays the thrushes, whom he's had to persuade that money is valuable. Have I switched off? To make him a nest, which he then uses as a boat to float himself across back to the mainland. Now, he could have floated in the paper pound note, £5 note, but he's blinded by the fact that that's money, and money is money, that he has to use it to pay for things. So all the time he's kind of playing with this notion of socially constructed objects. And of course he uses it to great effect in the pantomime when he says, every time a child says, I don't believe in fairies, there is a fairy somewhere that falls down dead. Because the fairy is part of a child's imagination. And if the child abandons it, then the fairy dies. In the same way that the Greek gods are now dead because nobody believes in them anymore. They're socially constructed objects. Now, we must move on. Between animal and human, which is where Darwin comes back in again. This is a big, long argument that runs through both books about what we sometimes call the nature versus nurture conflict. How much of the way we are is because we're animals, born that way, instinct and so on, and how much of it have we learnt in a civilised environment? And he doesn't answer the problem, we don't answer the problem either. But one of his boundaries is that where you have an artefact, something that is man-made, then you have to learn how to use it. Whereas if you're interacting with the natural world, you can be an animal and behave by instinct alone. And so Mamie, again the sort of Wendy character, continues to visit Peter, who's left behind on the island. And she leaves presents for him, but she has to leave letters explaining how humans play with them, because she knows that he will not know how to play with a human toy, but he does know how to eat food and live in a natural environment. Now, the next problem that comes along in thinking about animals and humans is how much of what we do is due to knowledge and how much is due to instinct? Why is it that animals can sometimes do things that, without being taught, that we have to learn how to do? How can animals migrate to Africa and come back the following year and land up in the same garden that they set off from? Whereas you and I may well be completely lost as soon as we're out of sight of familiar landmarks. How can this possibly be? And the temptation is to think in terms of some kind of secret knowledge, that animals are born with knowledge. Animals are not born with knowledge. But Barry clearly can see there's a problem here, because in describing how to get to Netherland, he says, second to the right and straight on till morning. That, Peter had told Wendy, was the way to the Netherland. But even birds, carrying maps and consulting them at windy corners, could not have sighted it with these instructions. So he knows that birds are superior, but even they couldn't do it. Now, fortunately, we now know the answer to this problem, because this was worked out by Konrad Lorenz and Nico Tinbergen, working between the 1930s in the 1970s, post-Barry. And they got the Nobel Prize for this work. And they showed that where animals appear to have secret knowledge, what they're actually doing is responding to a stimulus immediately in front of them, because that's wired in, because the stimulus is already there. So if I give you a lemon and you bite into it, you will pull a face, right? You've not been taught it's the right thing to do. You don't know you're supposed to do that. You don't have very much control over it. You just do it because you're ugh. And all of these clever instincts are actually based on responding in that sort of way to something that is immediately in front of you. And then that often causes a change, and then something comes back and you get big sort of courtship dances and things going on, taking the behaviour forward. And Tinbergen and Lorenz proved this by guessing what they thought the stimulus was, making an even bigger one, and then showed that the animals did the response even yet more than usual. Right? That's how they got the Nobel Prize. Now, if we go back to Barry, the Native Americans are out looking for the pirates on the island. Not a sound is to be heard, save when they give a vent to a wonderful imitation of the lonely call of the coyote. The cry is answered by other braves, and some of them do it even better than the coyotes, who are not very good at it. So coyotes are not very good at being coyotes, and he's put his finger right on something that was not discovered for another 50 years or so. Now, these are called supernormal stimuli, and they are viciously exploited in all commercial enterprises. Babies have eyes that are too big for their head, right? And we all go, ah, and there you go. And pornography, of course, is another example of supranormal stimuli. You need to keep them under control. Now, another interesting piece of cognitive psychology. This is contemporary with Barry. William James and Carl Langer in the 1880s put forward the bizarre idea, well, ostensibly bizarre, that your physiological responses tell you about yourself rather than that you understand the situation and then have an emotional response to it. What they said was, we do not tremble because we are afraid or cry because we feel sad. We know we are afraid because we are trembling, and we know we are sad when we cry. Now, it sounds bizarre because in many cases the things we are upset about are things that we have to understand. Someone's insulted us or something like that's happened. But it's actually proved very difficult to work these two things out. And the current theory now is that one never precedes the other. They are really very much integrated. But if you're emotions fail you, you do not know how you feel. People, when something really terrible happens, they say, I feel numb, I don't know. I don't know whether I'm upset or not. I have no feelings. So they are right in many ways. And Barry was latching into this, which he may well have come across because he knew Henry James, who was William James's brother, so he may actually have known this. In one of his stories, he has a Cinderella story. And the Duke doesn't like any of the ladies of the court, but then falls for the serving girl, usual story. And he feels so peculiar, having at last fallen in love, that he sends for the doctor. It's a very physiological story, given that this is 1900. The doctor turns up, opens his chest, pulls out a fob watch on a chain, listens to it ticking, pops it back, closes it all up, and says, I have the honour to inform Your Excellency that Your Grace is in love. All right? Very mechanical interpretation of emotion for that time. And he spread it also to movements and stance and behaviour. David, who's the boy who's listening to the stories that the narrator is telling, David tells me that fairies never say, we feel happy. What they say is, we feel dancy. And this is much like the modern theories of embodiment and mindfulness and so on. Now I'm going to get more serious, so wake up now, because I'm now going to talk about cognition and consciousness. Now these things always, arguments about this always fall apart because people mean different things. So I'm going to tell you the way in which I'm using the term consciousness. We have sentience, which is to have an experience of light and colour and so on. Whereas a plant reacts, we experience the light, right? And this depends on something called primary representation, which I'll come back to in a minute, but it's just the straightforward experience of the world around you. Stream of consciousness is the kind of normal consciousness of having a sense of the immediate past, the immediate future alternatives. Here you are, trundling through life, in a kind of flow. That's another layer of consciousness. And then you have introspective self-awareness, where you sit there thinking, well, what do I really feel about this? So that's a different level of consciousness. That requires meta-representation, because you're representing your own representations. You're thinking about thinking. So that's meta. Secondary representation requires you to be conscious, but also of the now, but also in a wider context, and the context gives you the secondariness. So, what happens next? Mental representation is largely about time and space. So primary representation is necessary for the single channel processing of the present. You're trundling along and you're doing whatever's in front of you, like small animals. Right? Secondary representation is required to recollect the past while staying in the present. So you've got two things going on at once. Or to understand that the future will exist and may be different from the present, and to imagine alternatives while remaining grounded in the present. So they're all about being able to cope with two things at once. Now, what's this got to do with Barry? Well, here we have a description of the fairies where they have Peter's childish level of cognitive development. Tinkerbell was not all bad. Or rather, she was all bad just now, but on the other hand, sometimes she was all good. Fairies have to be one thing or the other, because being so small, they unfortunately have room for only one feeling at a time. They are, however, allowed to change, and it must be a complete change, right? Just single channel processing. And Barry thinks that the ducks are much the same. Peter wants to know how to swim, so he goes and asks them. And they say, well, you sit down on the top of the water in this way, and then you kick out like that. What Peter really needed to know was how you sit on the water without sinking. And they said it was quite impossible to explain such an easy thing as that. Because they can't reflect. They cannot think about themselves. They cannot think about what they're doing. They just are. Now, because Peter can't think of the past and the future as being different from now, he's technically amnesic, all right? He can learn facts, and he can recognise things as being familiar because they're in front of them. So your mother is familiar. She looks familiar. You don't have to remember the last time you saw your mother. Your mother has a quality of familiarity about her, you see. So he can do that, but he doesn't actually know, so he sees people and they have a quality of familiarity, but they doesn't know quite who they are because he is amnesic. And he can't remember his own life story. So he goes to see the crow, where the crow is blessed with higher cognitive functions. This is a big tradition, of course, and much studied now, but I'm sceptical, personally, as to whether crows have higher cognitive functions. But we won't go into that, it's another talk. Now, sometimes when Peter returned, he did not remember them, at least not well. Wendy was sure of it. She saw recognition come into his eyes, as if he was about to pass them the time of day and go on. Once she even had to tell him her name. "I'm Wendy," she said agitatedly. He was very sorry. And we've all had that kind of moment, I think. But the important thing here is that Barry gets amnesia right. Whereas if you look at a lot of films, somebody comes in to hospital or something, they've lost their memory, they've lost everything, they can't remember whether they smoke or not. That's not how amnesia really works. So he's very, very observant. And he also realised that if you cannot imagine the past, you cannot imagine the future as being different from the present. That is also true of deep amnesic patients. And so he comes up with a phrase which you may well have come across before: to die will be an awfully big adventure. Don't think so. And Peter cannot do alternatives. All right? Peter never quite knew what twins were. If you think about it, twins are actually rather complicated because they're identical but in some ways, but they're different entities. And he could not work out what twins were. Now, Solomon, as I say, can imagine the future. And this is the demonstration of this. His stocking contained 180 crumbs, 34 nuts, 16 crusts, a pen wiper, and a bootlace. When his stocking was full, Solomon calculated that he would be able to retire on a competency or a pension. Pensions, you know, kids don't understand pensions. It's all far too far away. Now, we now know why, what it is that you need for all these aspects of secondary representation. You need a hippocampus, which is this thing here. All right, and this is your brain. That to the right is a dissected out human hippocampus, where hippocampus is the word for seahorse. And the anatomists called it a seahorse because I've put a little seahorse upside down next to it and it looks somewhat similar. So that is the part of the brain and its interactions with the frontal cortex that you need in order to be able to do two things at once. Right? You have to be here and think about there. Now, secondary representation and a hippocampus is also necessary, as I said before, for meta-representation, which includes the ability to attach a mental label to your thoughts, indicating, for your example, that your thought is a learnt fact or a wish or a belief and so on, or something you can see. If your mental labels drop off, your vision becomes an hallucination. Your desire becomes a fact, and so on. And these are some of the features of psychosis, right? But again, that's another long story. But that's one of the things that meta-representation is required for. It's also required for what we call theory of mind, which is knowing that other people's thoughts may not be the same as your thoughts, and that neither need necessarily accord with what's actually true. And to be able to do that requires you to be able to have what's called a theory of mind and to think about the thinking of other people thinking about you and so on. And we now know that what you primarily require for that is the frontal lobes, the bit above the glasses there, and that their interactions with the rest of the brain and the hippocampus in particular. So that neuroanatomy was not known in 1900, but it all joins up. Now, back to Barry. Peter subtly lacks mental labelling. Peter heard loud noises that made him look round sharply, though they were really himself sneezing. And the difference between Peter and the other boys at such a time was that they knew it was make-believe, while to him, make-believe and true were exactly the same thing. Oops. Because he lacks theory of mind, he also lacks empathy, which is not to say that theory of mind is about lacking empathy. People who lack theory of mind often have buckets of empathy, they just don't know when to apply it because they don't understand the situation. So here we have Peter and Wendy, where Wendy is flirting with Peter. Peter, what are your exact feelings for me? Those of a devoted son, Wendy. I thought so, she said, and went and sat by herself. You are so queer, he said, frankly puzzled. And Tiger Lily is just the same. There is something she wants to be to me, but she says it is not my mother. Not there's something I'm supposed to do, or I don't know what she wants, or any of these sort of me comments. It's I don't understand what's going on in her mind. Right? And here comes the empathy bit. He takes the children away and he doesn't tell the parents whether they're ever, ever going to come back, and it never crosses his mind that they might be upset by just doing that. Now, I'm sure some of you are child psychologists and the like, and you may be thinking, well, hang on, child development is all about pretend play. And when you pretend, you're here and you're pretending to be something else. How can you argue that children don't have pretend? Well, let's not call it pretend, let's call it pretense play. And Robert Louis Stevenson, who was Barry's mentor, had a very important insight into this. He said, a child cannot construct a story in the imagination, but has to act out the story, either in person, improvising with ordinary items to hand, or by proxy, with toy soldiers or other toys. The child can do this in spite of whatever else may be going on around them, intersecting but not joining that adult world. So the thing we admire about children's play is not that they're pretending to be such as that. They are. They're method acting, right? And there's a very subtle difference there, and I think that's quite perspicacious. Now, having put all this science into it, I asked myself the question, did scientists at the time know what Barry was doing? Because he wasn't a scientist. And it's a very difficult question to answer, but there is a... E.B. Titchener was a gestalt psychologist of the 1900s who wrote one of the very first textbooks of psychology. And instead of drawing on case studies and real examples and the like to make his point, he chooses a fictional character from another book by Barry. There's a boy called Dieter Deutschers who is a mole catcher. That's his role in life, from which we gather, I think, that he's not very bright. Okay? And so Barry draws an accurate picture of human conduct permanently arrested between impulsive and selective action, where impulsive action is like instinctive kind of behaviour and selective action is more thoughtful, considerate kind of action. So some of the psychologists knew what Barry was up to. Did Barry know what he was doing? Well, I know he was being very introspective, but I'm really not so sure that he was being deliberately so. But by 1930, he wrote a dedication to the boys that he had told the original stories to and who had been the inspiration for his Peter Pan stories. And he writes, "One by one, as you swung monkey-wise from branch to branch in the wood of make-believe, you reached the tree of knowledge." This is the dawning of secondary representation, grown-upness, all right? And we all have that kind of feeling. Did other authors follow what Barry was doing? Well, here we have A.A. Milne, who knew Barry very well and took a great deal of advice from Barry. And he says, "Childhood is not the happiest time of one's life, but only to a child is pure happiness possible. Afterwards, it is tainted with the knowledge that it will not last and the fear that one will have to pay for it." So again, we have that falling away of living in a mindful world of primary representation alone, joining the world of grown-ups. Thank you very much.